Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, which is Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is our engineer this evening. We have a fascinating topic for you, and it is the topic of China. What could be more in the news these days than our relationships with China from the U.S. and from many other countries also? And we have, as our guest this evening, Professor Tineke Dasler from Muhlenberg College. Tineke, let's spell your last name for the folks. Just they're hearing it for the first time.
Of course. D apostrophe H-A-E-S-E-L-E-E-R.
Okay, I was looking at my notes as you said that, and you spelled it correctly.
Yes.
That's a great beginning to the interview.
Thank you.
She's used to you. Oh, that's a tough one for people who do not come from Dutch, huh?
Yes, it's even in the Netherlands, actually, between Belgium, Flanders, where I'm from, and the Netherlands, people have in the Netherlands more trouble pronouncing it because it's not as common. It's very Flemish.
I see, yeah. Right. And you describe your native language as Dutch,
yes.
Not Flemish.
It's a little bit like the difference between American and British English, so you will immediately recognize the accent is different. We have certain grammatical constructions that are a little bit different, and definitely vocabulary. So when I started teaching in the Netherlands, the first few weeks, I really had to try hard and clean up my language because the students wouldn't understand me otherwise.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting. And your English is impeccable.
Thank you.
Full disclosure, I sat in on a course with Dr. Dasler's permission, a course on modern China over at Muhlenberg College, and the English was superb. So congrats on that, too, though you may think, oh, it's not such a big deal. You come from a fairly small country, and you say, well,
indeed.
If you come from a place like Denmark and you're going to publish anything, it's not going to be in Danish. Nobody else will read it. So
yes, and it's the same with Flemish or Dutch, which in the written language, it's much it's very similar, or it's pretty much the same standard language. But it means that if you want to write anything for a wider audience, and especially if you go into higher education and into doctoral work, English is going to be the way you do it. So I got my training in Cambridge at university. And the first year I was there was on an exchange. And I have to say, it was not just about learning classical Chinese, which was one of the main reasons I went there, but it was also about learning how to express myself in English. And after about 10 years on and off in England, yeah, this is the result. So
10 years on and off?
Yeah.
All right. But you must have started as a girl. With your English.
Yes.
How old were you when you had your first English class?
First English classes officially, I would have been 12, 13 maybe in school. But because Dutch and English are very closely related, and you also hear English a lot around you everywhere, it's just, it comes naturally. It's on the TV, it's on the radio, it's the pop songs you like. So you pick up a lot of things. And initially, when I first went to England, the difficulty wasn't so much the English, but it was the British aspect of it, because I had learned a lot of things from American friends through my brother. And a lot of those expressions were not known in the UK, or people just use different expressions. And for me, it was adjusting to British English was actually pretty hard. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And sometimes your pronunciation of things comes through as English mm-hmm. versus American.
Yeah.
You like, when we're talking about China, you say dynasty instead
yes.
of dynasty.
Yeah, I can't get, so? You know, every now and then it will slip through. And right. the tomatoes are starting to appear instead of the tomatoes when I order things. But so far, I've resisted the Americanization of my accent. Yes.
Yeah, and the idiomatic expressions that you're well into now, the students with a final exam no longer get nervous. They freak out.
Yeah.
So you've used that in class and saying, now, before you start freaking out, let me tell you.
Yeah. First of all, I like to reassure students there's no need to freak out. But it's also a term that I think has now become so commonly used that even in England, people would use it. Yes.
Yeah. We get homogenized with all this television and social media and whatnot nowadays. So you started off your education at Leiden, was that the first?
No, I started off in Belgium at Leuven University, Catholic University of Leuven, when I went to, well, It was a few years before that that I decided that I wanted to learn Chinese as a spoken language. That was my main goal. I just had this in my head. I was good with languages, so that was sort of the next challenge, was something with a weird alphabet.
That is a big challenge.
Yeah, and it was sort of a toss-up between Russian, Arabic, and Chinese. And Chinese won out for a number of reasons, but one of them was that the script really fascinated me. And then I went to an open day when I was, it was the final year of high school before I went into university. And the open day, I heard first year students who only had been there for a few months speak Chinese with their teacher. And I just was, okay, I'm not going to the philosophy open house this afternoon. That was the other thing I was contemplating. I was just, I'm signing up for Chinese here and now. And that's pretty much what I did. Yeah.
And that was in Leuven.
That was Leuven, yeah, in Belgium. And it wasn't until later that I got to Leiden as a teacher, actually. That was after I'd, I was finishing up my doctoral dissertation at that time.
All right. And you did your PhD at the University of Cambridge.
Yes, I did.
In St. John's College.
Yep.
On Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. That I have been told. I haven't been to Cambridge. I've been told it's just a gorgeous place.
Cambridge is fantastic, yes. So it's not really a campus per se the way you have it here. It's spread out through the town, but because the town is medieval, so you have all the old colleges and some of the more new colleges dotted in around the city center. And it's quite, you know.
And a river.
Photographic. Beautiful river where we went punting. Yes, I've done all the things. And having, you know, all the strawberries and cream and the garden parties.
Oh.
Yes, summertime in Cambridge is lovely.
Makes us all want to go there.
Yes.
Now, your dissertation was on the Tang Dynasty, or dynasty. I'm going to have to decide where I'm going with this one now. And the Tang Dynasty was basically 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries,
yes,
CE. You did Japanese studies.
Just the 1 year.
And that was 1 year, but that was summa cum laude. And then you did a master's in Sinology. So Sinology meaning?
Study of China. And in very specifically, actually, the study of traditional China and very traditional techniques of, you know, mainly text-focused. So I know how to use a Chinese library, which not every person who has done Chinese studies or China studies can say.
All right, so meaning that you can, you know how to read titles in Chinese and
use indices, use concordances, find snippets of text even when the internet is down. Yes,
all
I can
right.
do that.
And even when it's all in Chinese.
Even when it's all in Chinese. Yeah. We started early with that. Our training at Leuven University, we started with that kind of thing in the second year. So we barely knew how to read and write Chinese. I mean, we knew a fair amount, but it was really, really hard. It was one of the hardest courses, but it trained me really well for the PhD, because by the time I got to Cambridge, I actually knew a lot of the things they were trying to teach in that first year about how to look up books, how to locate titles, how to sort of look at text editions, all of those things. Well, 99% of that we had already seen by the time we finished our second year at Leuven. So the training at Leuven was fantastic, yeah.
And then you had language training, Korean Language Institute in Seoul.
Yes.
And so you learned some Korean.
Yes, I did.
And Shandong University.
Yep.
Is it pronounced Jinan?
In Jinan, yes.
Jinan, the People's Republic of China, which we would just say today China.
Yeah.
But they like PRC.
Well, I like to specify we're talking about the People's Republic mainland China rather than Taiwan, which is the Republic of China, and there's a bit of a fight between the two about territory.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
Complex. I'm sure that you remember from the classes that you sat in. Yeah. So I always like to make clear to people that we're talking about the state People's Republic of China, or the Republic of China located in Taiwan.
Correct. And the United States came very late in this whole development since the revolution in 1949 to recognize that mainland China is what we're going to call China now instead of Taiwan. I think it was around 1970 or so.
So yes, 1972 was the Nixon visit. That sort of was opening the doors after the ping pong diplomacy. And it wasn't until 1979 that the U.S. really formally acknowledged the PRC as the legitimate power, and that an embassy was located there. The UN recognition, that went a little bit earlier. That was shortly after the Nixon visit. So it took the US a little bit longer than the United Nations.
It was in the
Nations,
70s that this all happened.
But it was in the 70s, yes, yeah. Which to us doesn't seem that long ago, but to the students that seemed like, you know, a million years ago.
Yeah, exactly. there was a colleague of mine years ago who said that the students think would call the Middle Ages any time before the Truman administration.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's interesting when I get the students talking about early China, which is a very specific term in my field. Early China refers to anything before about 220 CE, and the students use it to mean anything before 1900.
Right.
And then, no. Ancient China, early China, we're talking about a very specific field. We also have late imperial. That's probably what you mean. So it's interesting to look at how conceptions of time really change. And especially when you're dealing with something like China, which has such a long history,
right.
Documented written information dates back to about, just off the top of my head, 2000 BC, when we have the first inscriptions. And yeah, if you're not used to that, if you live in a country that was founded in the late 18th century, then, you know, going back a few millennia is just, it's all one big mess
staggering
of things.
To us.
Yeah,
right.
It's just century after century of the same thing. So one of my tasks I see as a teacher is to really try and give students a sense that things do change, even though it's a very long time ago. There is change, and it goes maybe a little bit slower than it seems to go today, but if I can get that across, then I feel, you know, I've succeeded as a teacher.
Right. Now, the course that I observed was Modern China.
Yep.
Do you also teach a course, Traditional China?
Or? Yes, I do. There is an intro to Traditional China where we start at the very beginning. I even make sure that we go all the way back to the Neolithic before the writing happened even, and try and sort of get the students up to date with some of the new things that have been happening there and haven't made it into the textbooks yet. So it's really a challenge to get everything in from about, 6,000 BC all the way to about 1800.
Yes.
But we manage, yeah.
Wondering if the fact that in the title Modern China, if that would appeal more as a course to students from the U.S. because our history is short and we're always looking forward. We tend to think of ourselves not as such a backward-looking. So if you say traditional, it's almost a negative word sometimes.
It can be. But then I also find that there's a fascination among the students about something they don't know. So it's a matter of making them see that there are other things out there. You're right that modern usually draws a pretty big crowd. Although I'm teaching next semester Intro to Traditional Japan, and the class is full already. So I think there's a desire to know more, and part of it will be about, you know, how good a teacher you are to make that past come alive to them, and then hopefully word spreads around campus. But I think we need to give our students a little bit of credit. They may be drawn in at first by the modern because it's something they can connect to more easily, and it's something I noticed in some of the discussions we had. When we were starting to talk about things around, say, the 1980s, when China is sort of going through that first phase of reform and opening up, when you start to have some democracy movements that get, of course, quashed down, you could tell that the students sort of, they had something to hold on to from their own world, from their own experience. And that is harder to sort of create that in a class that's about traditional China or traditional Japan, where you have to not just sort of go across a geographical gap, but also across, you know, the time gap there is. And again, that's where I see my task as a teacher of history in trying to figure out ways, how can I make this connect? How can I bring out something of the past that they can connect with, that they feel is something like a human experience they can share? And that's a good challenge. It's not always easy, though.
It is a challenge. And lots of times in the course, you talk about Chinese thought, traditions, government, society, and so on, versus Western.
Yes.
And how Western thoughts and philosophy and government and so on affected Chinese.
Yes. And I'm not going to say the other way around, but in East Asia, the other way around as well, that China actually served for a very long time as a model for the neighboring states. So if you think about the development of Korean history, Japan, Vietnam, a lot of those ideas about how to organize a state, how to run a government, are actually based on traditional Chinese concepts. And that is something that's pretty hard to get across, that it's not just our Western traditions that we have here, whether you look at the European model or the way the US has turned that into its own brand of democracy. There is a counter-narrative there in East Asia that we are not very aware of, but that really plays a role in the way government is organized, the way some of the Chinese students in the class think about the world around them, and in particular about government in China. And that's always interesting to sort of have people realize, wait a minute, there's more to the world than just this one model. There's other ways to explain things. And I love it when that light bulb happens, you know, when yes. people suddenly have that insight.
And at Muhlenberg College, there is a certain number of Chinese students now. I don't know how many.
I don't know off the top of my head. Is it about 50? Might be a little bit more. I don't have the latest numbers.
But it just shows you what's been happening with the opening up of China, as I would call it, since the 1970s.
Yep.
That we're now having these relationships with students coming over here and our students going to China as well. So is it a big challenge for the professor to have a certain number of Chinese students in the class versus the American students?
It can be, but I'd like to think about it as another form of diversity in the classroom, which brings you new perspectives. And what I like to do is make sure that the Chinese students get, when I do group work, that they get sprinkled around the classroom so they can put a little bit of a Chinese voice into the debate. So one of the things I had in my first year seminar was a very revealing moment for me where I thought like, oh, this is why it's good to have a lot of people from different backgrounds in the room. They were talking about Shennong, which is a legendary man who's credited with the invention of tea. And we were talking about this legend, and I asked, okay, who knew about this legend before the start of class? And four hands went up, my four Chinese students. And they were like, oh, it's only us Chinese students who know this. But then the American students were, wait, everyone in China knows this, and we don't. And so I think that is a moment where the amount of people from China in a classroom can really help you to bring out that perspective again, that there is a different world out there. There is a different way of looking at the world. And here is the living proof. You have your classmates who have a different view of this. And to them, this is normal. Just like you think, wait, you don't know this. They will have things that you don't know and that everyone there in China shares. So that's in that way, you have to find the moments where you can exploit that.
Right. And exploiting, meaning that you can use the Chinese students in some way as resources.
Exactly.
In your classes.
Yeah. We've had it a couple of times where people would then sort of volunteer stories about their grandparents or parents in class, which I always love. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So right. It's again, that personal human touch.
Yes. And I remember when I met you and the title of the course was Modern China. And I said, well, in what century do you begin that? And you said, well, in the 17th century CE.
Yep.
And I said to you, oh, spoken as a true European, you think that the 17th century is modern. Whereas from our point of view, you know, let's talk about 19th century maybe being modern. But I'm sort of making a joke out of it. But that was the place where you chose to begin.
Yes.
And you asked students in the course, did they think that was a good place to begin? Not that they know better than you do. But you had different answers.
Yes,
some maybe we could have started later, but then some who agreed that they needed the background from 17th century. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Tineke Dazeler. She is a professor at Muhlenberg College, teaches about China, which I guess is your basic love.
It is.
And she is going to tell us more about how to get the study of Chinese and China across to U.S. students. We must take a break now. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is China and teaching about China, which has become a really widespread interest in the U.S. with the rise of China in the world, at least I would say economically.
Yes.
Probably mostly economically, right? And so one of the things that I think we ought to talk about a little bit is what misconceptions do we have about China? How tricky is it for us to get on the same wavelength with them to understand where they're coming from?
Oh, if you're asking me to give you a guide of what to do and what not to do, it's really hard. Because the thing is that if I say certain things about this is something they do or don't do, it can easily be misconstrued as a stereotype. But what I feel is one of the things that we misunderstand is, there's so many things, but the way people think about China is mysterious or things are not clear. Well, I would say learn Chinese and start following the news in Chinese. And then you will start to figure out that they do things a little bit differently there. But just like you have here, you have to watch for certain words that come out of the government in terms of signaling discourse. There's a very long tradition in China of doing that. Words carry great meaning. So if suddenly a fixed expression starts to change, that means you can interpret safely that something is changing with policy as well. So that would be something that I would recommend everyone who's really interested in China is learn Chinese. Don't call yourself a China watcher unless you actually feed on Chinese news feeds as well. Yeah.
You have you're working on a big translation project from a key
yes.
text from the 8th century. So
yes.
let's talk a little bit about that. How tricky is it to translate? Now, this is from
yes.
Chinese into English.
Yes. So it's interesting that you put that right after the question about modern China and economics, because in a way that text still carries some value many people will know it. And I'm not entirely sure if Xi Jinping has already picked up on it or what the latest is, but I think my colleague posted some pictures of seeing new editions of the text appear translations into modern Chinese, so it's easier to understand for Chinese
okay.
people.
Okay, these are texts from the 8th century.
From the 8th century, translated into modern Chinese that still are considered relevant about how to rule a country. So the document, the text that we are translating in Chinese is called Zhenquan Zhengyao, or The Essentials of Good Government from the Zhenquan Era. That was the reign title of the second emperor of the Tang Dynasty, who ruled from 626 to 649. And he was a figure who was very much a sort of primus inter pares rather than a despotic ruler at the top of the pyramid. He was open to criticism, at least if we can believe the sources. He was ruling his empire with his ministers as colleagues rather than as subjects. Or at least that's the image that we get from this text. The text itself was created in the 8th century, so about a century after his rule, and it's idealizing his rule in that particular way, that government should be a consensus between the ruler, the emperor, and his educated ministers, who all have been trained in Confucian style, statecraft, and classics. And the reason why we decided to translate this text, well, first of all, it started off with a joke. Me on my blog joking about, oh, I'm going to do one of these every day, and then I figured out every week, and then I figured out it's really hard to translate classical Chinese, because guess what? It is.
Yeah. Now, the Chinese, to interrupt you,
go ahead.
The Chinese that you learned along the way, and that's modern Chinese.
I learned modern Chinese, but in Leuven, where I got my great training, remember, we also learned classical Chinese from the first year on.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the big differences in the U.S., between the U.S. and the European traditions of studying China, is that in the way we specialize early on, you get classical Chinese from the undergraduate level. And so it meant that by the time I got to my fourth year, which I did an exchange in Cambridge, I could actually pick up a lot of extra classical Chinese, but had a good foundation already to start diving into these kinds of texts as an undergraduate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, I'm so interested in languages. How about a Chinese person who obviously speaks Mandarin or one of the other dialects of Chinese and is trying to deal with a text from the 8th century? Would that person have to study classical Chinese just the way you did?
Yes. If I'm not mistaken, they teach that in secondary school, so middle and high school in China. I don't know what the best comparison would be, whether it would be like Latin is compared to Italian, or whether it is like medieval English is to, you know, anything before Shakespeare is to what comes after Shakespeare. You need a little bit, you can recognize a lot of the constructions and a lot of the ideas, a lot of the characters, of course, that helps. But sometimes words are used differently, and there are certain fixed expressions that really are different between modern and classical or traditional Chinese. So it does mean that I read with greater ease the classical Chinese compared to some of my Chinese students, yes.
Interesting. Yes. And so getting back to the text from the 8th century.
Yeah, so it started off as that joke, but then there was a friend of mine who picked this up and said, well, this is a really key text in East Asia. So this is one of those texts that contributes to that idea of a shared culture in East Asia between Korea, Japan, China, Vietnam as well. And the text was actually translated into various other languages. So it was taught in classical Chinese because that was a language of education for the Korean crown prince, for the Japanese crown princes. But it was also translated into Mongolian, into Khitan, Jurchen, which are languages which are in the northeast of China. They no longer exist. But once upon a time, these people ruled, after the Tang dynasty, these people ruled the northeast or northern part of China. The Mongols, of course, Genghis Khan and his successors, they conquered the whole of China. So the fact that this text was considered so important from the Chinese, it was translated into these different languages, it really is, it's going to be... I think the best comparison is looking at it, some of the great classical texts we have on government from, say, I don't know, Thomas Hobbes maybe, or think about Adam Smith's text. You know, it's that kind of level of influence. People will have heard of it. Not everyone may have read it cover to cover, but the key ideas are known. And so we feel that bringing this kind of text in a full English translation to a wider audience is really going to help us open up that conversation about where is China different from the US or from the West, and what are some of the traditions informing East Asia as a whole. So that's why we felt it was important to bring this text.
And nobody has tried a translation into English?
There have been parts of it, but one of them was squirreled away in a master's dissertation, so it's not very accessible. Our translation will come out with Cambridge University Press and will be widely accessible.
Yeah. Excellent. When do you expect publication? Is there?
Apparently, we're going to the printer on the 15th of January. Oh. So I have some corrections to make and check after all the grading is done. But yes, it's going fast. We're in the final phase. The reason why we were able to do this is actually because we were collaborating with about 8 or 10 people. I keep losing track. But yes, we've got some of the greatest people and then some more junior people like me, working on this project together, looking at each other's translations, making sure that we get homogeneity throughout the text for the key concepts, so that even if you're working with a translation, you still know that a certain idea that's mentioned in the first chapter, when you come across it in the 9th chapter, that term still signals the same idea.
How is this a single text that we're talking about, or is
Yes.
it a collection? It's a text. How long?
The critical edition in Chinese that we are using is about 300-400 pages, but that includes notes as well. Although it is a single text, every single chapter consists of little anecdotes about encounters between the emperor and his officials. And so this is the way Chinese history and historiography works, is that you don't lay out the principles. You tell a story, an anecdote, and then from there, the reader will derive the meaning. And so history is essentially in that way teaching you everything you need to know. A good reader, an understanding reader, will know how to interpret these texts. The hardest bits to translate were not so much the stories, but the memorials, because sometimes they include an entire memorial. That's a very lengthy piece of policy advice to the emperor. And they use very flowery language because you're talking to the emperor, so you've got to make sure it sounds good, you have the right classical references. And that was the ones that really took a long time because you have to chase up the references, make sure that you're translating them correctly. And even so, I don't think we catch all of them. At least I know I didn't.
You're working with 8 or 10 other people.
Yes.
On it. Do you get to meet some of them sometimes?
Yes, we did. We had a couple of meetings at Leiden University where the chief editor is based. And it was great to just be in the same room with these people.
Exactly.
And talk with them and swap ideas and really hash out, okay, which edition are we going to use? Because there are multiple ways you can arrange the anecdotes, and that has happened over time. Remember, we're talking about a text that dates from the 8th century, so how that has come down to us is a story in itself. And there were some serious discussions about certain terms. How do you translate these? What kind of connotations does that give to a reader who is not clued into the background we have? So translation is really, it's hard work. But that is why it was great to meet, to be together with people for 2-3 days. And then discussions would continue over dinner and over breakfast.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it gives you an idea of who. I agree with that. Being in the same room with people is different from
yes.
doing email.
Yes.
And yeah. telephone and whatnot. Are these scholars from many different countries?
Yeah. So my former supervisor from Cambridge University is part of it. We had someone on the team from Oxford University. Unfortunately, he passed away. But not before helping us really a lot already with some standardizing of terms. We've got a few people from Leiden University, someone from Albany, New York University, Albany. I'm trying to think. People who are now in, I'm trying to remember. They just moved positions, so it's
right.
hard to keep up.
But
someone from Princeton. So there's a lot
a
of different
people. From the U.S.
A few from the U.S. And then there's someone from Hong Kong as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the one Asian who's in the group.
Yes, I'm trying to think if there are more Asians. It's been a while since we've all been together in the same room. But yes, mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah.
And I'm guessing that the original text, if you can. Maybe you're just imagining that there was an original text, but you don't have that extant
anymore. We don't have
anymore.
That. No.
So how much time would have passed between the writing of this? Let's suppose it was written in the 8th century, until you have your first manuscript that you can read. How many centuries later would
I'm
that
trying
be?
To think if we. I mean, the version we use is an edited volume from fairly recently, from 2011. And that was someone who consulted earlier versions. I'm now trying to remember how exactly the story went. Part of the text, because all of these different places translated it into their own language, and because it was also exported to the Korean Peninsula and Japan, those editions would also have informed the way the critical edition has come into existence. Essentially, that's part of the project I've left to other people who are more familiar with this kind of thing. I daren't off the top of my head give you a date when we would have had a full edition of the text. But it would have been a few centuries, I reckon.
You're working with bits and pieces.
We're working with bits and pieces, but at the same time, China has a really lengthy tradition of preserving texts and passing them from one scholar to the next or from one library, imperial library, to the next. So for some texts, we actually have manuscripts that date back, 1,000 years more. And then, of course, there is on the Silk Road in Dunhuang, there is a library cave that was discovered in 1901 that had been sealed off since about the year 1000.
Oh, wow.
And so there you have actual material that people haven't touched in over 1,000 years. And that's a whole specialist field of study. But a lot of that material actually comes from the Tang Dynasty or is contemporaneous with the Tang Dynasty. But that's an entire field in its own, and I'm studying the other side of the Tang Empire, so I leave that to the specialists.
All right. What are the different sides, then, of the Tang Dynasty? Let's talk about that.
Oh, Oh, well, where to start? So my own research is mainly when people ask me, what do you do? I say, oh, Tang Foreign Relations, which is part of the story. I look at foreign relations, the Northeast in specific, but also the relations with that frontier region, which in the second half of the Tang Dynasty is pretty much autonomous from the court. They still are officially in a recognized relationship with the court, but the governors there do pretty much their own thing. You have people who study literature, which is really a really massive field. There's a lot of poetry that has been preserved. It's also the time when stories that we start to recognize as fiction are becoming very popular, stories that still are turned into films nowadays. So it keeps being part of Chinese culture. In terms of economy, the Tang Dynasty is a very important time. It's one of those big unified reigns when a lot of neighboring countries will engage in trade with China. And the result is that the economy really blossoms. There's a lot of changes happening in the dynasty between beginning and end.
Again, we're talking 7th, 8th, 9th
yes.
centuries CE.
Yes.
For the Tang Dynasty.
Yeah. And there's a whole lot of different things that people can study. There's also an enormous amount of texts available about religion, popular religion, Buddhism. So pretty much anything you want to study, you can study in the Tang Dynasty. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Tineke Dasler, who is professor at Muhlenberg College, and she teaches about China and things Asian. One thing that caught my eye, Tineke, is a course called China's Magical Creatures and Where to Find Them.
Yes.
Now, is that a title that you concocted yourself?
Yeah, that was during a phone interview for a job, and they were like, oh, what would you propose for a 100-level seminar? And I had this idea in mind for that kind of course after talks with a colleague about weird creatures and sort of supernatural phenomena. And I was like, well, you know, and I would call it something like China's Magical Creatures. I got the job, and then I had to teach the course.
That's a great story. We have to take a break now on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is our engineer this evening. And we thank you all for listening in. This is such a fascinating topic. It's China. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY's bylaws provide for two member representatives on the board of directors to serve as the voice for the members. One representative is elected each year, and nominations are being accepted to replace a member whose term expires at the end of 2019. If you're interested in applying, please send a letter of interest and bio resume, specifically noting any WDIY volunteer work, as well as any community service that you have done, by noon on Monday, September 30th, to nominations@wdiy.org.
China is our topic, and Professor Dr. Tineke Dasler is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Let's go to discovery of some new materials. Mm-hmm. As a result of economic development in China, excavations of tombs, archaeological sites, and they apparently are revolutionizing many parts of Chinese history, right?
They are, yes. The one where it's most visible, I think, and one that many people will be familiar with is, if you think to the terracotta warriors of the first emperor, many people may have seen them somewhere on an exhibit.
Right.
Because there seems to be a set of traveling warriors going around, and they were last year in Philadelphia. So if you think about that, that was a really big find. And I'm not saying that we're finding things on an equal scale, because we're talking about the first emperor. But from that time period and slightly earlier, there's a lot of tombs that are being found. And I'm very happy to be a Tang historian who's working in that 7th to 9th century slot, because things are going slightly less fast than for that early China time period, so anything before 220 CE, where the way we think about some of the really core ideas about Chinese philosophy or Chinese thinking that really have given shape to the way Imperial China functioned, a lot of those ideas date from a period called the Warring States, which was 5th century through 221 BCE, if I get my dates right. Mm-hmm. When different states, China was not unified, different states were fighting for advantage against each other to try and conquer them and unify the whole of China. And one of the ways that they were fighting with each other was trying out new ideas about how to turn your state into a better state, a more aggressive state, one that would win. And so the idea we had was from the text that had been transmitted to us from back then by copying manuscripts all the way to the present. And that sort of gives you an idea of, okay, Confucius, Lao Tzu, some others, those are the really two big names. There's a number of other schools and ideas. And then we start finding, well, I say we as if I'm digging these things up, but people start finding tombs where entire libraries have been preserved. So people would be buried, if they were important enough, with their writings, with the idea, of course, that this would serve some purpose in the afterlife. So we have found legal texts, but also a lot of texts that we have the received tradition, the transmitted tradition that we know and love and has been translated a million times. And then you have snippets or sometimes longer sections of those texts, but almost like a snapshot from the 3rd century BC, the way the people then would have read it and used it. And what turns out is that a lot of these texts have, we think of them from, you know, the received editions being, oh, this is 2,000, 3,000, 2,500 years old. They have changed. Editors have subtly changed things when you compare them with what you find coming out of these tombs. And it turns out that the variety of ideas and the variety of texts was much wider than we ever thought. And so we completely have to rethink. What I learned as an undergraduate about that time period is no longer valid.
And what is the time period?
And that time period is 5th century to about 3rd century BC.
All right. And the first emperor is from that time period?
Yeah, so that would have been 221, I think, he's when he finally unifies. I'm not good with dates for a historian.
No, this is not true. I've observed. You're very good with
dates. I never ask students to memorize dates because I can't do it either. If I know them, it's because I use them a lot. But think about 220 BCE to about 206 when that first emperor rules. So it's right, the century is right before he comes to power. And then also into that first dynasty that succeeds him. So that's where really things have changed a lot and where I feel very unconfident teaching without swatting up a little bit the night before, figuring out what the latest discoveries are because it moves so fast. For my own research in the Tang dynasty, the 7th to 9th century, it's also changed a lot. One of the things that we have been finding there that's been really useful to get a different sense of this dynasty is the so-called epitaphs. Now, we think of as an epitaph of something that stands on top of a tomb, but these are texts carved in stone that were buried inside a tomb. And the idea was that this would identify the tomb if it got disturbed, which is one of the ways that we know who's buried there, but also it may have had a religious function in terms of explaining to the ancestors or explaining to whatever deities and spirits are around who this person is. But these epitaphs are very lengthy at times. They contain up to a few hundred characters. So you get a combination of the pedigree, the family history of this person, usually following the male line of descent, what offices they have held, who they're married to, and if the children are old enough, where the marital connections are. So from my point of view, what's been interesting for this is that the official histories that have been passed down to us, which were produced at the court of the Tang dynasty, they're good. They're great. I mean, compared to anything else from the 7th century I can think of, they're very, very detailed. But they give you sort of an insight into the 1% of the top layer of the elite, the emperor, the people who really mattered and were close to him, and anything that's sort of coming from peasants or the barbarians, between air quotes as they're called, that would only be mentioned insofar as it had an impact on what was happening in the capital or with the emperor. These epitaphs, they've been absolutely fantastic because they give us a little bit more of an insight into people who are not part of that top elite. It's still fair, you need a lot of money to bury someone in that style. But it really has given us a lot more insight into local government, and that has been really informing a lot of recent work.
And is there a time period in the last, I'm going to say, few centuries, where these discoveries of the tombs and certain texts have started to come to light because suddenly there was more interest in pursuing?
Yeah, there is. It's one of these things where people sort of, when they first find these, there's like, oh, well, that's nice, but, you know, whatever. But the past few decades, really, people have cottoned on to the idea that there are so many of them that you can do systematic studies. So I'm looking at these, mining them for specific information. I look for certain keywords. But there are people who run statistics on these, and that really has shown things that were not possible to see without access to these materials. So one of the interesting things that came out of this is a study of how the elite was constantly able to reinvent itself during the Tang Dynasty, even after the big rebellion, which took place in 755, that has been memorialized in so many different ways as you know, the end of times. Oh, no, the Tang recovers. But then actually, the elite just keeps going. It's not until the 1880s, when there is another rebellion that massively wipes out that layer of population, that you see start to see big social changes that then lead into the next dynasty. And we wouldn't really have seen that without looking at the data that comes from these epitaphs. So in that sense, we get a very different view of what's happening, or we get alternative possibilities and scenarios of how to interpret some of the big changes in Chinese
history.
That's
really exciting.
Yeah,
for
it
folks
is.
Who are doing that kind of
yeah.
study.
Yeah.
Yes. Earlier in the interview, Tineke, you mentioned the Silk Road.
Oh, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because many of us have heard of the Silk Road, not sure exactly what it was.
Yeah, so talking about it as one road is a bit problematic, because you should imagine it as a network of trade routes that connect the East and the West on the Eurasian continent, and even Africa would be part of it in a way. So people have always traveled, people have always been curious. Goods have traveled even further because they travel a few stops along the roads, and then you end up with a Buddhist statue in a tomb in Sweden in the 7th or 8th century, for instance.
Oh.
You have silk found in a tomb in Stuttgart in Germany in 3rd century, 6th century BC? It's way before anyone else is producing silk, so you know it comes from China. And this is at a time when we think, oh, China is insular, people in pre-modern society didn't go about much. Well, I'd like to tell people, no, they did. People traveled, goods traveled even further. People were curious about the world around them, just like we are now. And so the Silk Roads has become this idea of the connections between China and Central Asia, and from there further into the Middle East even. The term itself was invented in the late 19th century by a German geographer who was figuring out silk was the most valuable commodity that was traded here. Silk for the Chinese at that time in the Tang Dynasty was actually used as money. It was the equivalent of writing a check. So you could express the value of certain goods in the amount of bolts of silk. There was a standardized number that was part of the taxation system. So a horse could go for 40 bolts of silk, for instance.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like we think of gold as being a standard
that
you could use.
Yeah, except silk was a lot lighter to travel with.
Exactly. Much more practical.
Yes.
Right. Do we have any idea of what products were taken by people farther west going to China, and they would be bringing back silk? What would they take to China?
Well, it wasn't just silk that went out from China. There's a lot of different things. If you're interested in what went into China, there's a really lovely book by Edward Schaefer. It's called The Golden Peaches of Samarkand, and it's a study of Tang exotics. So all the goods that came into China from the outside world. So golden peaches was a reference to a certain kind of fruit from Central Asia. We don't quite know what it was, but it's there. Gemstones, pigments that were used in cosmetics or in the Sanzhai, the three-colored glaze that was used in the Tang Dynasty. That's the precursor to what we know as Chinaware. Horses, people, animals such as falcons for hunting, certain kinds of feathers and furs. I mean, whatever you have in terms of material culture, it was being traded. China really was at the time of the Tang Dynasty when this trade network as the Silk Roads, when that was at its height, China was so connected with the rest of the world and was really an economic powerhouse that was drawing people into it. And then things went from, say, Southeast India into China and then moved into Central Asia. So spices would have been traded as well. There's a lot. There's so much. I can't even begin to list everything yet.
Yeah, big activities going on in China at that time. The couple of words that we've heard also that are very famous about China. One is the Great Wall. Give us just a little taste of what that was, why it was built, what's the time period?
Well, okay, we need another hour then. Because the Great Wall, what you see now, when you go and visit China, what you see now is a reconstructed version that's been cleaned up and made safe, which is a good idea, that dates actually to the 15th century. It's not, that section is not as old as you think it is.
Oh.
The Great Wall that we think of as, oh, that monument from ye olden days, it goes back to the same first emperor with the Terracotta Warriors, who is reputed to have connected the walls that other states had built and connect them into one long series. There's been a lot of, again, talking about things that have changed, insights that have changed. We think of a wall as something to keep people out. In this case, the nomadic groups to the north, they have to be kept out. In the case of the Ming Dynasty, when you look at the wall, so that's the more recent one, if you look at where it runs, and it's sort of it's like that dragon that sort of goes across the hills, yes. You know, at the highest points. I mean, honestly, no sane nomad on a horse would ever think about trying to go up a hill like that, let alone across a wall. So I think it's more of a sort of a status symbol or a warning signal, like, hey, this is China, we are here. And the wall could also be used, if need be, as a sort of a base for armies going further out north. And that is actually, if we go back to the origins of the Great Wall and the myths connected to it, if you look at the first emperor's Great Wall and that version of it, what you have there is definitely indications that the Great Wall was just a way of occupying territory from the nomads, claiming it for the own dynasty so that they could rear horses, which were needed for the warfare, and then even use that as a staging post to get further out into the nomadic territory. There's some really fascinating research that's been done that really reconceptualized the wall as something not to keep people out, but to advance the Chinese territory or the Qin territory.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And another term that we hear of is the Long March.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting to much more recent
That is much more recent, yes. So we're talking then about really the way the Communist Party survived in China against the odds. It has been turned into something of mythical status, but I don't think it should be underestimated what people were doing at the time. So 1935, if I get my date right, mm-hmm. then is the moment when the Communist Party is really under pressure from the alliance that had broken down with the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party. And there was thought to be only one way out from the southeast part of China, where a lot of the communist forces were located in the Jiangxi Soviet. And that was just to break through the barriers that had been set up, sort of multiple lines from the Nationalist Party, to try and break through and just relocate to somewhere else. So 1935 is when this happens, and it takes about a year for about 80,000 people to start moving, and only about 8,000 of them will finally make it all
That's
the way.
Only a tenth.
Yes, it's enormous. So some of those people were killed. A number of them deserted as well, because they just were like, well, you know, I can't deal with this anymore. I'll just sort of melt into the background. And
the long march would be how many miles?
Oh, gosh. It goes all over China. So you go all the way west into sort of southern Sichuan, and then you have to imagine them going across the Tibetan plateau or sort of skirting the outside.
Thousands of miles.
I'm hesitant to put a number on it because numbers in China are so big.
Yes.
So without actually having it in front of me.
Right.
But yes, it took them a year, and they went specifically through territory that was really, really harsh, because that was one of the ways the communists hoped to deter the nationalists from following them, because they went where there was no food, where it was really hard going, where there was snow, where people, you know, got frostbite. And the idea was, well, if we go there, then at least the nationalists won't be following us. And then this is also the time when Mao Zedong started gradually to sort of assert more of his leadership. And eventually he came out as sort of the top leader by the time they got to Yan'an, which is in North China. That, you know, that was the area where they found another communist little hotspot that they could connect to. And then from there, they started rebuilding the party. And so Mao Zedong became the main leader. So the Long March played in many ways a big role in cementing his status as the paramount leader
of
China.
So that's the 1930s.
And this is in the 1930s, right. Yes. Yeah.
Right. Well, Tinica, our time is up.
Too bad. So many other things to talk about.
I know. There's so much. And we do appreciate your taking time out to come over and talk with us here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Dr. Tinica Dasler, who is Assistant Professor of History. Actually, I've seen it in writing that Assistant Professor of Chinese History. Now, what's your title exactly at Muhlenberg?
My official appointment is Assistant Professor of History, but I like to make clear to people that China is my passion.
Okay. Now I understand. Right. And so this topic of China will continue to fascinate us and interest us. There's more and more opportunity for those of us who love to travel to go to China and spend some time. And Dr. Dasler is saying, don't just content yourself with seeing the sights. Learn some Chinese along the way.
Oh, yes.
Right? Which is not an easy task for most of us. Well, thanks to you listeners for tuning in this evening. Thanks to Neil Heaver for working the board for us. I'm John Pierce here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.